You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Thursday, 24 October, we got AfriMat results due within the hour. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Chantal Marks. Famous Brands results. Is it modest revenue growth, but they seem to control costs well. Is it better than Spurs? Spurs still the winner. Stanlib Senior Economist, impact of and challenges faced by China. Deborah Slabber from Morningstar, a different perspective on SA equity. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in their global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb, AfriMarkets, Bank XO's emerging twin. MoneyWeb investigation reveals identical business models and links to fake ads. Business Day inflation slows for fourth month, further raising rate cut prospects. Old Mutual chief economist Johan Els, he says Reserve Bank could cut 50 basis points, 0.5% in November. He has hoping. Morning markets, US was red, S&P down 0.9%, NASDAQ off 1.6%. Over in the east, it is mixed. Sydney and Tokyo both up 0.5%. Hong Kong down 0.7% and Tencent off 1.2%. Commodities mix, gold 2,738. Brent is higher at 75.92. Platinum 1,036. Palladium is higher at $1,106 an ounce. Rand 17.77. Bitcoin 67,300. And top 40 opening call, a slightly red open, 25 points, or what's that, 0.03% down.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Chantal Marks, Head of Research, F&B Wealth and Investments. Chantal, appreciate the early morning. The famous brands results. I mean, they've kind of got their gourmet burger now fully behind them. We saw headline earnings up 9.5%, revenue up 2%, dividend up 9%. This really suggests to me that they're struggling but managing costs. I mean, revenue up 2%. I got to say, food inflation is probably a whole lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, revenue was quite disappointing. I think it was due to a number of factors. The lack of load shedding probably being one of them, because mm-hmm. Famous Brands is in the quick service space. So it's your quick takeaway when you don't feel like getting out the camp stove to cook. So I think that has had an impact. And then obviously the consumer has been under a lot of pressure. But what I take from these results that I really like is the fact that they've managed to rein in costs. They've brought down debt significantly. Cash flows are looking decent. And now we're going into an environment where there are actually economic tailwinds. There are actually tailwinds for the consumer. So I think they're really well positioned now. They look better than they did in the last interest rate cutting cycle, much better. They're scaling back Nigeria. They're out of the UK. It just looks a whole lot better to me.
Yeah, and I take your point around the load shedding. It cuts both ways. Signature Brands, which is sort of like the fancy sit-down, also taking pressure because, as you said, we don't need to haul out the camping stove. Suddenly we can cook at home. Spur's obviously the big competitor here. I was going to say a strong balance sheet. I mean, that underplays a balance sheet with absolutely no debt on it. Maybe a little less QSR for Spur. Contrasting the two, is it bits of both? Is one standout better than the other?
So I think it's bits of both. I think if you asked me a year ago, I would have said, just stay away from Famous Brands. It just isn't worth it. I would have been completely wrong because the stock has returned 18% over the last year. But Spurs returned 29%. And I think it is that unencumbered balance sheet that they have, and also the model, the family sit-down restaurant model. I myself am a mom of two small boys, and I promise you, when it rains, I'm in a Spur. Mm-hmm. So I think that that has really helped them, and that will probably continue to help them as consumer wallets, the pressure on consumer wallets ease. But I was looking at both of these companies at 20-year total returns. So that includes dividends. And Spur would have given you 14% per year over the last 20 years. And Famous Brands would have given you 15.8% despite the drama in the UK and all the crazy acquisitions that they made around about 2016. So I think there's a place for both of these companies in your portfolio. They're different. They're exposed to the same dynamics, but they're different. And both, I think, are in a very good position going into a much better macroeconomic environment.
Yeah, and those are both actually good numbers over a 20-year period. Quick last question. No debt. Does Spur have a lazy balance sheet? Should they be out and buying something, or are we comfortable with them saying, you know what, we're sticking to our knitting?
I think the fact that these are quite cyclical businesses makes the case for being a little bit more conservative on the balance sheet side. I think with these companies, these big transformative acquisitions don't generally play out well because you meet up with management teams that have a completely different way of doing things. Famous Brands, really, I think with their big acquisition in Nigeria and the big acquisition in the UK, kind of proved that. So I think conservative, small bolt-on acquisitions, building out the manufacturing and retail portfolio with existing cash flows is probably a decent way to go, unless you see a really big major ramp up in economic growth in the jurisdictions in which they trade. Then build on what you already have, and then you can take on a little bit of debt. But I think a conservative balance sheet is probably best for cyclical companies just generally.
Yeah, I like that view. It is cyclical. It's going to get tough again. Be careful, I suppose, is the answer. Chantal Marx, Head of Research, FNB Wealth and Investments. Always appreciate the early morning. And that's our LinkedIn and Twitter this morning. Spur, Famous Brands, which is your preferred? Perhaps like Chantal, a bit of both, or perhaps neither for you. Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn and Twitter. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
I'm Jonathan Ndivhuyo Netajenga, Stanlib Senior Economist. Ndivhuyo, appreciate the time today. A recent note you put out around China. It had some amazing figures, which I think intuitively we know, but we kind of forget. The years from 1990 to 2019, what, 9.3% real GDP growth, an absolute giant number. But since 2019, it's been a lot harder for China. And in fact, I mean, they're struggling to get to their 5% target at the moment.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Simon. And yes, China has been going through some serious issues since the pandemic. And it's not just the pandemic that has really caused growth to really fall so far to even below 5%, but it's also some of the traditional engines of growth. They've become quite unsustainable, really, and have created some imbalances within the economy that have now become more of hindrances to growth than drivers. Some of the established policies that they've relied on in the past to boost growth in times of sort of cyclical downturns have become quite blunt and quite ineffective in recent years.
There is, I take your point on that. I mean, there's structural issues that are now sort of baked in. Lack of domestic demand. You talk around low consumer confidence. You talk around industrial overcapacity. Does the stimulus that they've announced, I mean, does this do enough? I mean, is this going to fix what are structural problems more than anything else?
I think with the stimulus, if you will, it's basically on both sides, right? So we're having the national policy stimulus coming in from the central bank in China. And then there's some fiscal relief measures that they've also announced in early this month that they're also hoping to help boost economic growth. From a economic growth perspective, we think that it will play a role in boosting. It might not necessarily get China to that 5% mark, but it's definitely going to ensure that it is on a better path going forward, especially going into 2025, where we will see even better boost in growth. But from a structural perspective, it's unlikely to tackle the issues that they are facing structurally. I mean, a lack of domestic demand, some of the fiscal policies that they're implementing really is to boost your producers and boost your manufacturing sector and investment sector, but it doesn't adequately address the weak household consumption and the social lack of social welfare support that a lot of consumers in China require in order to boost confidence. So from a structural perspective, it really doesn't do much, but it does try to get maybe growth across that line, that 5% target that they have. we believe that if they're implemented as soon as possible, it will get there.
Is there a risk? And as I'm about to say, it almost just sounds crazy. Is there a risk of China almost becoming Japan? Their inflation has for ages been beyond their sort of unofficial 3%. They're still doing good growth, but it's not the target. I mean, is that a real risk, or is perhaps a bit alarmist from myself?
I think there is a risk that China does sort of go within the roots of Japan in the 1990s, where they faced prolonged levels of deflation. And no matter what policies they implemented, they just weren't able to get their consumer spending again. Now, China, obviously, is their growth. And I know we're speaking in terms of they will be able to reach their target, and it's very low compared to historical growth levels. But 5% is still a respectable growth level. And this year, we expect 4.9. In 2025, it's going to be 4.7. Still quite respectable. But if deflation is not addressed, we could actually see a faster deterioration in China's economic activity, because, as you know, with deflation, happens is your consumers see that prices are going down, yeah. So they delay spending so that they can spend at a later time. So we could see that, I guess, role in terms of they don't spend now, they wait till prices are lower, and every single time they keep waiting, then the economy does worse and worse, and deflation is cemented. So that risk is there. Luckily for the Chinese government, they have some capacity within central government to really boost spending. So if they just throw money, I don't want to say it like this, but if they can throw money at the problem in terms of trying to get deflation out, they'd be able to really do it before it really does some structural damage to the economy.
I take your point. And deflation, as much as it sounds nice, you're 100%. I'm not going to buy my big ticket item if I think it's cheaper in a year. And in a year, I think it's going to be cheaper in another. And it's that vicious tailwind. A last question.
Exactly.
We're seeing sort of China sort of pushing out exports to try and help the economy, running lower margins. That sort of makes exports cheaper. China's our biggest export partner. That must be helping us a little bit, particularly in our fight with inflation.
Definitely. I mean, if you look at the numbers that came out from inflation today, they definitely beat our expectations, coming in below 4% for the first time in, I think it was about 3 years. So even though a lot of that lower inflation from our perspective comes from the fuel price, you can't deny that some of the lower prices coming in from China that we're importing is really giving a nice headwind for our inflation and bringing that down quite nicely. And I think we can continue to benefit from that as long as China doesn't do anything that will get their economy in more trouble, because obviously there's that angle where if economic growth is bad in China, it is the second biggest economy in the world. Like you said, it's our biggest trading partner, both on an import and an export perspective. So if they don't have any growth, then that really will impact our exporters, especially our commodity exporters, in terms of them being able to sell stuff into China.
There's lots of hope around China from a South African perspective. Commodity prices is definitely one, because they're so hugely important, not just to our economy, but to our fiscus. We saw that in 2021 when Treasury was making a fortune off the higher commodity prices and resultant taxes. We will leave it there. Sindivoya Netshenga, Stanlib Senior Economist. Appreciate the time. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the Stanlib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Deborah Slabbert, Director and Portfolio Specialist, Morningstar South Africa. Deborah, appreciate the early morning. There's a sense of euphoria happening around South Africa right now. Load shedding is gone. We've got the Government of National Unity. It kind of makes me think a little bit of 2017, the Ramaphosa we had back then. Is it different this time? My gut says to me it is different. Is that a fair response to say things are different in 2024 compared to 2017?
Good morning, Simon, and thank you for having me. And I guess that's the ultimate question, and only time will tell, I guess, but I share your sentiment. I do think, yes, a lot of the recent price movement we've seen, similar like in the Ramaphosa area, has been sentiment driven, but it does feel like this time around, there's a bit more substance around it. And I'll tell you why we think that. First of all, the earnings outlook for these companies are starting to improve, and that's been stagnant for many years. But we do need fundamentals to catch up properly, so I'll state it with that. Mm-hmm. And then I guess, secondly, we have seen some headwinds that are turning into tailwinds. For instance, load shedding, as you just mentioned, is one of them. Plus, we're in a much more favorable interest rate environment today, which would provide a welcome relief. And I think thirdly is probably the bigger macro backdrop that also plays a role here. South Africa is just a small open economy. We're very vulnerable to what happens to the in the rest of the world. But emerging markets, how they stack up to developed markets, mm-hmm. we know that they are much more attractive today. There have been lagging developed markets. And then the question becomes, how does South Africa stack up within that emerging market complex? And would foreigners actually come back to our market? So I do think there's a bit more substance around the sentiment, improved sentiment this time around.
And I like your point around earnings. I mean, it has been very tough being a business in a South African-focused business over the last decade and a half, perhaps. You can go back to 2010 almost. And they've survived. But now we need that sort of kicker. We need to see the companies coming with those better earnings from the improved conditions on the ground.
Exactly that point. So I don't think fundamentals have really caught up. Mm-hmm. So that's the one point that really needs some substance behind it. And then I guess the other point that would really move our market in a more substantial way is if foreigners do come back into our market. Yes, they've actually come back into our bond market. We're seeing our local auctions being quite well supported, actually. Yeah. But that's on the bond side. On the equity side, we haven't really seen foreigners coming back into our market. And as I mentioned before, maybe this is the time where they look at South Africa in the broader emerging market complex. And because of less political uncertainty and our market still looking very attractive from a valuation perspective and the improved economic outlook, maybe just that sparks the interest for foreigners to come back.
I get that, because that was going to be my next question. What gets those foreigners back? I think, a week or three after the election back in May, one of the big banks, and I can't remember which one, out of the US, upgraded South Africa from underweight to overweight. We need the others to start coming. And I suppose what they're saying is, it looks nice, but I suppose show us some evidence. And again, that goes back to, let's get those earnings coming. They want to see it in the ground before they bring their hard-earned rands, or dollars, sorry.
Exactly. And if you look across the globe to global asset allocators, they're actually still pretty much underweight South Africa. And yes, we form such a small part of the broader index, but just a little bit of earnings and a little bit of price movement might just spark interest. And we might see a huge amount of flows coming into South Africa. We've come from an era of everyone being long US tech, ignoring everything else. Mm. And on top of that, we are sitting with, there's a lot of cash sitting in money market accounts around the world, and especially in the US. So what happens if that money actually gets deployed? It could be very good for South African equities.
Yeah, it's going to start needing a home, because it's not getting much in its current environment. A last question. From an investor perspective, there's been I think over the last many years, a skew to sort of being offshore. You mentioned the tech hype, etc. Time to start pondering and maybe not repatriating some money, but start to deploy more into our market in anticipation.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Simon, what we've done from a Morningstar perspective, we've been unweight South African equities for a long period of time now. And yes, that's lagged the broader global market, especially US tech. But now is a time where I think we're just going to keep that conviction and keep our equity position. And maybe it's time where we see asset managers actually starting to reallocate money back to South Africa. And on top of that, you do have, we've had a period of very prolonged dollar strength. Mm. And we are starting to see small signs of that also reversing. I think South African equity should do quite well for investors going forward. But it's all about having the right mandate in place and having the right balance in your portfolio. Because as I mentioned, South African equities, the range of outcomes are still quite wide, mm-hmm. and you do have the lumpiness of that in a portfolio as well. So it's all about portfolio construction and what you want to achieve at the end of the day.
Now, that's a great point. And it's never sort of all in one side or the other. It's about managing the construction. We'll leave it there. Deborah Saba, Director and Portfolio Specialist, Morningstar South Africa. Appreciate the early morning.
That's it for today. We're chatting with Mateta Tulari yesterday around the Sasol production update. So little change, but markets sold off the stock and then it sold it again yesterday. We asked if you were holding Sasol. Over half of you said holding and hurting. Yo, there's a truth. Almost a third said, no, this is a mess. The rest said you are waiting for a turn, waiting patiently, it would seem. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. If you're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobokhle, Seren, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Spear, read results.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now. On the money.